Very big thanks to the 2FM Drive team this evening. It is Tuesday, the 8th of July, and you're listening to Game On with Andrew O'Connor. Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, Paul Curry and Mark Langdon discuss transfers, the Women's Euros, who will win the Club World Cup, and does anyone really care? We'll also look ahead to the Shelburne and St. Pat's matches in Europe this week, while Irish tennis coach Gary Cahill gives us the latest from Day 9 of Wimbledon. We'll look ahead to the Lions' latest obstacle with Michael Corcoran as the Pride prepares to take on the Brumbies. And Shane Stokes looks back at a very exciting day in the Tour de France that saw Tadej Pogacar power into yellow. As always, if you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552 or WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200. Now, before we get into all the chat, let me give you a couple of headlines from the day. It's quarterfinals day at Wimbledon. Taylor Fritz has reached his first Wimbledon semi-final with Carlos Alcaraz currently up against Cam Nori, while top seed Aryna Zabalenka and Amanda Anisimova have both made the women's semi-finals. A major setback for Australia ahead of their first of the three test matches against the Lions. First choice out half, Noah Neleseo, has been ruled out, while Newcastle United have agreed a £55 million fee with Nottingham Forest for winger Anthony Elanga.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Yeah, not a sunny evening, but plenty of sport to talk about. Delighted to say I am joined by Paul Curry in studio. Happy Tuesday to you, Paul.
Happy Tuesday, Andrew.
Yeah, plenty of sporting action today. I know I was glued to the cycling and to the tennis, and you watched a bit of the tennis as well today.
I certainly did. I mean, last night, first and foremost,
Sinner was very lucky to get through. I actually watched the first two sets and then made my way to the golf course, switching it off, thinking that Dimitrov was going to get through. Looked down at the phone and I couldn't believe that Dimitrov had obviously picked up an injury and Sinner was very lucky to survive. What could have been a huge shock last night. And then again, watching Sabalenka earlier on, I thought she was in difficulty in the third set. Maybe lost a bit of composure. Wasn't too typical with Sabalenka, but in true Sabalenka fashion, found a way of winning and getting through that third set. So yeah, I've been glued to it. I think it really starts to heat up now, doesn't it, as we start to hit quarterfinal and semi-final time. And great to see, you know, some of the bigger seeds still in the draw and still there and potentially teeing up some great games before now and the end of the weekend.
Yeah, Gary Cahill's going to be joining us later on in the programme, so we're going to have a lot more tennis chat. Paul, you can join in as well as me on that. Lots of soccer to talk about. We're going to talk about that in a minute and talk to Mark Langdon as well from the Racing Post. But bit of news, breaking news, the GAA has confirmed that Liam Gordon from Galway will be the referee for the 2025 GAA Hurling All-Ireland Senior Championship Final between Cork and Tipperary on the 20th of July. That will be Liam Gordon's first senior final. So a big day for the Killamore clubman. He also refereed the 2019 under 20 final between Cork and Tipperary. So he has some experience of the counties meeting. And it'll be the 18th Lee McCarthy Cup game to referee his first final since 2020. So umpires in today, Damien Gibbons, Alan McLaren and John Larkin, while Ollie Riley will also be there. They're all from the Killamore Club, so a big day for them coming up on the 20th of July, as well as Cork and Tipperary, of course. So plenty of soccer chat. Let us start. The Euros ongoing, of course. Germany trailing Denmark in the 5 o'clock kickoff. They're about to get underway in the second half. Paul, I don't know if you saw any of that first half, but Denmark leading 1-0.
I didn't actually see much of it as I was on the way over, but we were chatting on the weekend, myself and Damien, and you know, just it's a real sort of testament to having a 16-team tournament when you see the quality that has been on show and how tight so many of the games are. I mean, naturally enough, Spain are probably the team that have be most impressive in their first two games. They just seem to be so creative going forward and will cause so many teams trouble as this tournament goes on. And obviously with England, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not they can navigate their way out of the group after what was a pretty disappointing performance against France, I thought. Probably a little bit below their levels, and they've obviously got difficult games against Netherlands and Wales coming up. So it's a really tight tournament. It's actually been a really fascinating watch. I know maybe lesser teams in tournaments aren't as favourable for Irish teams qualifying, but it certainly does make the viewing quite good.
Mark Langdon joins us as well. Mark, have you been? We'll get to England in a minute, but have you been impressed with Spain? They hammered Belgium last night in front of the King of Belgium, but very, very impressive.
Yeah, I mean, Spain have been the absolute standout team so far. I don't think there's any. You don't get any prizes for originality there, really, given the scores that they've put in. The one thing you would say, I know Paul there was just talking about sort of the quality of the teams as sort of, it is improving. They probably haven't sort of beaten that much so far, Spain, and their quality and the way that they keep the ball and move the ball, I think, has just been too much, particularly for Belgium, but also Portugal. So it'll be interesting, when they come up against a better team, just how they're able to kind of, still dominate. A lot of the focus has been on England's bad performance, here where I live. But I actually thought as well that France were probably better than maybe I was expecting. Looked really dangerous down the wings. And so, Spain haven't played anybody of that quality yet. So, been the best team so far, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, and as we saw, Italy yesterday could only draw against Portugal. And I was interested to hear the commentator say that Italy haven't won two international competitive games, I think, for 20 years in women's football. So that sort of puts that into perspective. Let's talk about England a little bit more, Mark. I know, obviously, in England, there'll be a lot more analysis and chat and attention on it, particularly being the reigning champions. A disappointing start, but as you say, the French midfield was very strong. What is the difference between this England team and the all-conquering one of a couple of years ago? I know a couple of personnel changes. Is the sort of the management, is it getting a bit tired?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's definitely, I think, question marks about the way that kind of experienced players kind of retired, and you can put that in inverted commas, sort of on the eve of the tournament. And that did suggest that maybe things were not kind of all well, and results actually have not been that good for a while. If you go have a look at sort of Nations League, there was some bad performances in there. They lost to Belgium in one of the games, and they reached the final of the World Cup, and I don't think they were probably as good as what they were when they won the Euros, when they reached the World Cup final and probably took advantage of a soft enough draw really to get through. So I think this has been a team on a downward spiral for a while. There's question marks mainly over the midfield, and you mentioned there, Andrew, about the fact that the French dominated the midfield area. Lauren James was playing off Rousseau and had Hempen and Mead on the wings, and that was a controversial call, in as much as I think those that kind of watch a lot of women's football were suggesting that there needed to be an extra midfielder in there, whether that was Ella Toon or Grace Clinton, just to kind of, I think, I suppose, dominate that area more than was the case. So that'll be an interesting call to see whether they do revert to that, because it's massive gain now against the Dutch. Not sure Netherlands beat much. Wales, I know that they come through against Ireland, but the lowest ranked team in the tournament, I would expect them to, they've got the hardest draw, I'd expect them to leave pointless. So I think it's all going to come down really for England in terms of staying in this competition, by beating Netherlands tomorrow. So some big calls to be made. The one thing you would say is that you probably shouldn't panic. So, it is only one game. There was a very narrow VAR call that sort of denied England in that first 15 minutes when they probably played their best stuff of the game up until the last few minutes. But it was that middle kind of hour, really, where France got a grip on midfield and they just couldn't sort of cope with the quality on the wings. And they need to keep like Miedema quiet tomorrow as well. But this is a team that not used to criticism and has probably come in for more in the last few days than they have in sort of the last 3 or 4 years.
They're slow starters, though, traditionally, so be sort of no major panic for people who know English women's football. I suppose they'll be just sort of saying, we'll play our ways into this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that's been the case in previous tournaments, but they've not been in a group like this previously. You know, it was a real shocker of a group, you know, to play France and then Netherlands in your first two matches. There's no time for slow starts, and you're right, Andrew, to say that they haven't sort of hit the traps and come flying out in previous tournaments, but they've had much easier paths and have been able to to just go into the tournament slightly. There's no more of that. I mean, if they lose to the Dutch, they're basically out. So that needs to stop, really. But I thought the centre backs looked edgy. Greenwood and Williamson probably not getting that protection from the midfield. And it really is a big game. And like I said, I think for a lot of the sort of English players, they've had nothing but praise. They won the Euros on home soil. Then they reached the World Cup final. It's just been sort of all positive vibes, really. And now they're having, for the first time, to deal with criticism. And then you're getting people, and I'll include myself in this, that don't watch Women's Super League every single week, that are invested in this tournament, that are sort of shouting off about them as well. So, there is, the women wanted more attention. They wanted more hype. They've got that. And with that comes expectation and now pressure.
And criticism. I was asking Alan Cawley yesterday, had any, apart from the major, the obvious teams like Spain and England, had any of the teams really impressed him? And he had picked out two of the German wingers, Jules Brand and Clara Bull, who are currently in action against Denmark and losing 1-0. He thought they were brilliant the other night in their first game. Have any teams, Paul, sort of stuck out to you other than the obvious ones?
Well, I think France were particularly good against England. I know we were pretty critical of England and maybe not having substantial control of the game, but I think you could see within that French side that there's so many threats at which they can get at teams. They're in a prime position within that group now, whereby they'll play Wales in their next game. You'd expect they would win. And you could see them growing into the tournament and being one of those major forces alongside the likes of Spain. So they're the team that have really stuck out for me. Very interested to see that kind of England-Holland game tomorrow. If Holland draw that game with England, England are in big, big trouble in that group.
Mm. And Mark, anyone sort of out of the ordinary, has anything caught your eye?
Well, I think what's really catching the eye is this game that's currently taking place with Denmark beating Germany. Wouldn't have been many people that sort of predicted that at the start of, I was going to say at the start of the tournament, I was going to say at the start of today. Really, so this would be an upset.
It's only 52 minutes, Mark. It's Germany.
Yeah, there's still a long way. Yeah, still a long way to go. But I think that would be we're on the way to what would be a stunning result, really, there for the Danes.
Let's talk, Mark, as we do every Tuesday to you, I think, because you're the only person who ever talks to us about this. The Club World Cup, it's coming down, it's eking its way towards some sort of a conclusion. Of course, tonight, the first of the semi-finals, Fluminense up against Chelsea, and a couple of, a familiar figure, I suppose, Thiago Silva, inspiring Fluminense, and will he be able to do it tonight?
He's had a good tournament. Yeah, somebody like Thiago Silva, he hasn't had pace for, it's probably about a decade now, but he is just, he's in the right position. He knows the game inside out. He's a great leader. There's a lot of reasons as to why, he played at the highest level for as long as he did. And, he is an important player, not even the oldest player in their team, but by the way, got veteran goalkeeper as well. But in terms of this game, I would probably edge just towards Chelsea. Chelsea have not been brilliant so far. Let's make no mistake there. And I think that their lack of a world-class striker means that it's always a slight grind for them, and they have to just edge their way towards victories. But the way that Palmer scored in the last game, I thought it was a brilliant goal and amazing first touch. I mean, he's been just somebody that hasn't been scoring for them. If he has now sort of found his confidence and form again, I think he's the sort of one player on the pitch for either team that just takes the game away. And I think in these kind of really big matches, and I know people will maybe scoff at the thought of this being a big match, but it's a semi-final of a competition. Both teams will definitely want to win. Once you get this far, it's a big game for sure. And I just think Chelsea have probably got those extra players that decide a tight game, and Palmer being the most obvious of those.
And as we speak, Germany about to take a penalty in that game against Denmark. And I will keep you, Paul, will you keep an eye on that? Just behind us, it is Germany trailing Denmark by a goal to nil and about to take a penalty. Will they equalise? And yes, they will. Lovely penalty into the corner. No chance for the keeper to stop that. So 1-1. And as we suspected, Germany have come back. Before we we'll talk about more Chelsea strikers in a second when we get to our transfer slot, because they'll surely buy about 10 more before the transfer window finishes. But tomorrow's semi-finals, another interesting one. PSG up against Real Madrid. They'll be sick of the sight of each other, Mark.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sick of the sight of them playing each other, though, because, I mean, these are two teams that I think are really good to watch. Paris Saint-Germain, European champions. They lost to Botafogo earlier on in the competition, but Luis Enrique made a number of changes for that game. They've taken it more seriously since they've reached the sort of the knockout stages, went up a level against Bayern Munich in the previous round. Did lose two players to red cards in a chaotic and crazy last 20 minutes, but they did manage to beat Bayern Munich by 2-0. Doué and Dembélé on target for PSG. And I think the fact that they scored their second goal, now they were 1-0 up, they were down to 9 players and they had 6 men forward when they scored their second goal, which just goes to show you kind of their attitude and their commitment to playing on the front foot. So they're definitely favourites against a Real Madrid team that's still finding their way under Xabi Alonso. They've come for a couple of sort of difficult games against Juventus and Borussia Dortmund, but this is another few levels up. Interesting to see, I think, probably whether Kylian Mbappe starts. Scored a volley against Borussia Dortmund off the bench. Has been struggling for sort of full fitness throughout the tournament. In his absence, Gonzalo Garcia of the kind of youth teams come up, stepped forward and scored a lot of goals in this competition. And Xabi Alonso has suggested he might be the new Raul, which is praise indeed for any player coming through at Real Madrid. But he also said that he wants his players to be kind of interested in all phases of the game. Now, he didn't mention which players he was talking about there, but there was a clear, disconnect between defending and Kylian Mbappe and Vinicius Junior last season under Carlo Ancelotti. So you won't be able to do that against PSG. There's no way they'll be able to cheat and, have a couple of players that are not tracking back. So, I mean, this will sort of tell us whether Xabi Alonso's reboot, sort of where they're at in their development. Because if you beat PSG, you're doing something right, because they just look quality all over the pitch.
Paul, do you think now it might start to get interesting? Will you give it a watch?
Oh, I think I watched the PSG and Bayern Munich game on the weekend, and I think the eyes will naturally be drawn to PSG and Real Madrid, given what the players that they have on show and the form that PSG are in at the moment. And I think they're probably the most entertaining team to watch with some of the players that they have on show. Just Doué, Dembélé, Barcola, Kvaratskhelia. There's just so much quality when they go forward, and I'm sure there's an appetite within that squad, given the run that they've been on over the last couple of months, to go and win this competition, to put Real Madrid away. And you would certainly fancy them, Andrew, kind of where they are at this stage. Real Madrid under Xabi Alonso probably trying to embed a couple of ideas and a couple of new players into that system. So you'd have to fancy PSG from here to go on and win the whole competition. They've got so much quality, more quality than any team left. And I'm a Chelsea fan. I'll watch the game tonight and I'll watch PSG and Real Madrid tomorrow night. But still, it doesn't carry, for me anyway, as a football fan, too much weight. It'd be great if your side win it, and maybe you'll shout about it then, and obviously the finances to come with it. But it's kind of games that you're not taking too seriously.
Well, one man who may feature tonight, Paul, and you'd probably be interested to see him in a Chelsea kit for the first time, is João Pedro, Chelsea's latest striker signing. I think I read somewhere in a couple of days ago that in the last 3.5 years, Chelsea have spent £560 million sterling on strikers. One of them will eventually work, Paul.
Yeah, they're still searching. They're still searching there. Joe Pedro's probably not your out and out number nine who's going to lead the line. He quite likes to drop deep and get involved in play, and he's a fantastic dribbler of the ball, and he can carry the ball through the thirds. There was glimpses of him when he came on the other night. I thought he looked pretty good. He's got a great build about him as well. But it is staggering to think the amount of money that they have spent on forward players, and you're still looking at a team and wondering whether or not they have that out and out number nine. Liam Delap has obviously come in as well, and there'll be pressure on his shoulders to potentially score that kind of 15-20 goals and maybe be that fox in the box who can hopefully help Chelsea win more games. I mean, it's been very evident over the last 18 months that Nicholas Jackson, unfortunately, has just scoffed up too many chances. You know, he's got great attributes in his game. He's very quick. He's very dangerous when he gets in behind, but he just shows no composure in front of goal. And that's probably the reason why there's conversations of him being moved out of the building and potentially focusing on Delap and João Pedro to lead the line. So it's scary to think that they've spent so much money. I still think they're short a centre-half, a goalkeeper. Questions still to be answered around the players that they've brought in this summer, whether or not they're going to fill the void. But João Pedro is definitely a player that you can get excited about.
Yeah, the manager, Marcus, said that he'd prefer to see five strikers score 12 goals each than sort of one score 40. Would you agree with that logic?
It's never healthy to be relying on one striker, because if they get injured, you're really short. And we saw that with Man City for the first half of last season. They had nobody. They sold Alvarez, didn't they? And didn't replace him. And then Haaland got injured, and they had nobody up front. So I sort of agree with that logic. To a point, really, and it's probably one that Mikel Arteta, I think, has tried to embed at Arsenal as well, in that kind of holistic approach to attacking, and everybody gets the goals, and you can, there's definitely some benefit to not having that out and out striker. I think, often it means that you can link the midfield better. There's probably sort of team framework that can work well with somebody, and then you get somebody that is only interested in scoring goals, and it can break other parts of the team if you put them in it. I just don't think Chelsea have had good enough players, really, in that sort of area. Nicholas Jackson has fallen short. I do like Delap. I just think it's a lot of pressure on somebody of his age and kind of where he's at in his development. If he becomes the number nine for Chelsea, I wouldn't be that surprised. I mean, they've got so many wide players and sort of, what you just call forwards rather than strikers, that there might be something creative there where, Palmer and João Pedro could, play as sort of, two kind of tens in that forward position. Now, I just wonder if Maresca might be trying to cook something up that doesn't rely on one player up front, because the way he's stockpiling these attacking midfielders and wide players, he's going to struggle to keep them all happy next season, that's for sure.
Let's move on to Arsenal, Paul. Mikel Arteta finally getting his business done. Zubimendi finally signed up and released. Norgaard is also there, and they're trying to get the striker from Sporting Lisbon.
They certainly need a number nine. I mean, you speak about Chelsea and lacking that kind of focal point at the top end of the pitch. Arsenal certainly need a centre forward, and they've tried different recipes with Gabriel Jesus. They tried Martinelli through the middle.
Kai Havertz.
They've obviously thrown, his name deserts me now, the Spanish Moreno at the top end of the pitch as well. Like, at some point they were just going to have to throw the kitchen sink, spend big money and get somebody into the building. So it looks like it's going to be Gyökeres, and he's going to lead the line, and he's obviously had a fantastic couple of seasons at Sporting Lisbon, but it's a different ball game when you come to the Premier League. I know he's experienced English football with Coventry, but coming into the Premier League, it's a lot more physical, it's quicker. He has the attributes, and he'll be in a side that's going to create a huge amount of chances, but there's still question marks over that signing and whether or not he's going to be the proven goal scorer for them. I think Zubimendi is a fantastic signing. They've obviously had one or two exits from the midfield from last year. I think he will sit a little bit deeper. He'll free Declan Rice up to go play further up the pitch, and he is certainly somebody that will add to the quality of that Arsenal squad. There's also talk of them going for Nani Madueke, and as a Chelsea fan, I'd be happy enough to move Madueke on. Like, he's just nowhere near clinical enough in the final third. He's dangerous, but for me, lacks that kind of killer instinct.
Good business for Arsenal, Mark?
I think Zubimendi definitely totally agree that you'll get more out of Rice as well, and I think Norgaard is one of those sensible signings that is not going to get anybody too excited, but if he has to play a handful of Premier League games next season and sort of just do a job, he's somebody that knows the Premier League. He's done well for Brentford, so I think that's sensible. Gyökeres absolutely fascinates me because it doesn't sound like he was Arsenal's first choice, and that maybe they preferred Sesko but were struggling to sort of get him out of Leipzig. But Gyökeres has got a brilliant goal scoring record, and I'm not saying he'll be a flop, but he's 27, he's never played in Europe's top five leagues, and I think it's 29 minutes in the Champions League knockout stages. Like, that is a big leap of faith to put kind of that amount of money into somebody that you're hoping wins you a title. And they've only got to go one place, Arsenal, from second to first, but it's the most difficult kind of jump to make. I was talking earlier about the pressure on the England women's team. I mean, the pressure on Gyökeres will be astonishing, because you know Arsenal fans do get excited, and he's kind of just going to become this great hope for them to win the league. And if they don't win the league, he'll be a flop, and if they do win the league, he'll kind of be a hit. It sort of just feels like it will be like that for him, and I don't think you can sort of just go, yeah, he's an absolute banker for goals, because he's just not played at this level previously. So I'm not saying he can't do it, we just haven't seen him do it.
The problem for Arsenal is that everybody in Europe knows they need a centre forward, and the valuation is probably going to be double. You see that phone ringing, it's Arsenal Football Club, you double the price immediately, because you know they're absolutely dying for a centre forward.
Newcastle also may have suspicions they've been taxed a little bit. 55 million for Anthony Elanga, is it too much, Mark?
I would have thought so. You're right. You know, there is, you know, people know that Newcastle, given who their owners are, have got kind of money. They're in this weird position, somebody like Newcastle, because they've got a good 11, really, and it's hard to know where you go to kind of improve that sort of side, if you like. Eddie Howe does really well with players, and I think he improves players, but I think 55 for Elanga just does feel high. I mean, he's got pace and a very direct style, but I don't know. It feels to me like there are better sort of options out there, but maybe those players don't want to go to Newcastle.
Mm. Tierno Barry and Mark Travers, Ireland's Mark Travers, both rumoured to go to Everton. We'll talk about that when it happens, if it does. And Man United still nowhere with Mbeumo or anyone else. Mark, are you hearing anything that could happen in Old Trafford soon? Or
I think United are, they are trying, there's no doubt about that. But we talk about a Newcastle tax. I think Manchester United have had a kind of United tax for a long time now, and I think they are also actively trying to get rid of players as well as bring them in. And when they're on the kind of wages that they are at Old Trafford, that's a difficult job. And you know, they might need to get some players out, or at least kind of on the verge of getting them out, before they can start, you know, really putting the pedal down in terms of incomings. I would also say that because of the way that the financial year is reported now, that most teams have waited until the start of July before doing their business. So, there's probably still a lot going on in the background, but teams have just had to wait until July because of PSR rules.
Mark, thanks for joining us. As I predicted earlier on, Germany have come back now. They're now leading Denmark by 2-1. So, what's rare is wonderful.
Played a lotto tonight.
Even a broken clock is right twice a day. Mark, thanks very much for joining us. We will speak to you next Tuesday. Paul, before I let you go, a quick word on Shelburne and St. Pat's in European action. Shells take on Linfield in their first leg tomorrow of the Champions League qualifier first round. And St. Pat's on Thursday take on Hegelmann of Lithuania at St. Richmond Park at 7:45. Two tough tests?
I'm not sure they're tough tests. I would expect Pats to get through over the course of the two legs. I know they're not in scintillating form within the domestic campaign, but I think they've got enough players, quality and experience to navigate those two ties. I think, naturally enough, the Champions League tie is the one where eyes are going to be drawn. Like, Shells and Linfield is such a huge game, and the first leg tomorrow is such a big game for Shells to put down a bit of a marker and try take a lead up to Linfield and get out of that that round of the Champions League. I mean, they've got a huge advantage, Andrew, in the sense that Shelburne are in the middle of their season. Players should be kind of hitting their peak. I know maybe form and confidence hasn't been brilliant throughout the season, but they should still have an element of match fitness that Linfield just don't have. And they are in the middle of their pre-season. They've only played two games since the end of the last campaign.
Do legs always feel heavier in pre-season?
Yeah, they do. They absolutely do. You need a couple of weeks. You need a couple of games before you start to feel really fluid. So I think that's a massive advantage for Shells. And I'm hoping tomorrow that they can put a lead together. But even if that's only by one goal to take up to Linfield next week, and it'd be great to see both teams get through.
Yeah, okay. Stay with us. We're going to be talking tennis after this break. Game on. Tennis. Welcome back to Game On. It is 6:34 this Tuesday evening, and I'm delighted to say that tennis coach Gary Cahill joins us on the line in a very, very busy day at Wimbledon. Gary, how are you doing? Well, happy Tuesday to you.
Yeah, same to you. Yeah, busy day. Good matches today.
Great matches today. Let us start, because I'm going to want to talk a little bit about yesterday as well. So let's fly through today as much as we can. Will we start with the women's, Sabalenka and Siegmund. And it was a slow start for Sabalenka, but when she got motoring, she powered her way through.
Yeah, look, to be honest, Siegmund looked like she didn't want to win the match at the end of the match. She was kind of hoping that Sabalenka would miss. She got very defensive. And it ended up where, you know, Sabalenka got a lot of opportunities. But I don't think, to be honest, Sabalenka played her best tennis yet in this tournament. She's been playing quite well, but still not on her best. When you see someone like Siegmund, who's just like slicing forehands at the end of a match, just not really believing that she could win it. But for her, like, it's been a fantastic tournament. No one would have called her getting to this stage at Wimbledon.
It was a great first set, though. I mean, she had Sabalenka rattled, or seemed to have her sort of at least, I don't know if it was rattled, but annoyed anyway with herself.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, but then like getting over the line is the big part, and that's where the best ones like Sabalenka can eventually pull through. You know, the experience of someone like her, as opposed to like Siegmund, who hasn't been really at the back end of slams, wouldn't have the same experience. And that showed at the end.
And in the other women's game, which I didn't see, Anisimova overcame Pavlyuchenkova, excuse my pronunciation, in two sets. The first set seemed to go well, and the second set she seemed to sort of hesitate a bit.
Yeah, a little bit the same. Pavlyuchenkova is experienced. I mean, look, she's one of the veterans on the tour. It's been a great tournament, but had every chance in the second set, went to a tiebreak, you know, a very close tiebreak, had chances to win it. But like overall, I think Anisimova is actually probably at this point the better player, but still a great, great tournament for Pavlyuchenkova.
Okay, and in the men's, of course, Cam Nari is up against Carlos Alcaraz at the moment, and Alcaraz, as expected, is leading two sets to love and is 3-2 up in the third. But there was an intriguing battle earlier on in the day, and it was the Fritz who he started like a train against Khachanov, and then he seemed to just fall asleep in that third set.
Yeah, it seemed to be something wrong with him in that third set. I think it was a blister or something that was that niggled at him. He switched off a bit in the third. Really poor third set for someone like him. But look, managed to get through it. He's had a great tournament. He really came through the tough way. Played probably the biggest servers in the tournament in the first two rounds. But look, Fritz is a good player. Second semi-final of a slam, somebody who has the potential to win a slam at some stage, and definitely grass is one of, I'd say, his best surface.
Has he enough to cause Alcaraz problems in the next round?
I don't think so. No. I think Alcaraz looks in really good shape. Alcaraz's first round didn't look great, but since that, he's really been in good form, and he's someone with the kind of game that he has who can remarkably switch from clay courts to grass courts very quickly. I think even like quicker than Sinner. Because of the variation he has in his game, he can do most things. He can slice, he can drop shot. He has a combination of all the games, which on grass has made it very easy for him to adjust to. Yeah, he looks really, really good. It's going to take somebody to play a great match to beat Alcaraz, I think.
Can we just talk about yesterday a bit? Because there was so much drama and a lot of it came around about sort of injury and sort of bodies failing. First of all, it seemed like Jannik Sinner, I don't know if he was suffering from some tennis elbow, but that's what it looked like he was getting relief from at a certain point. Mm. And he looked in real trouble, two sets down. And then, you know, his opponent, I mean, it was just so heartbreaking. It was really, really heartbreaking. Just could not continue. And in the third set, had to give up the game. And even Sinner looked devastated for him.
Yeah, like, you know, if you looked at that match 15 minutes before that happened, you would say, look, Sinner looks injured here. This match is finished. And then, yeah, Dimitrov looked like he pulled a pec on one of his serves. Yeah, it's hard, you know, it's heartbreaking for someone like Dimitrov, because he would have always looked like someone who had the level to win a slam. Like, he was the best junior in the world, untouchable, like way better than most of the guys who've won slams as a junior.
And Gary, was he just unlucky in his era? Because he came into an era where there were just so many dominant players. Yeah. Was he just unlucky with the timing?
Yeah, but he was always there or thereabouts. Like, he always looked like someone who was good enough to win a slam. And just last night, it looked like this could have been his time. And, like, gut-wrenching for him that, you know, one serve could ruin his tournament. And look, it was really nice to see how Jannik Sinner reacted to it.
Yeah,
classy. You know, you could see that he genuinely felt really sorry for his opponent, and it just shows the other sign of Sinner, a great champion, but, you know, also a really good guy on the court and off the court.
He's been a bit unfortunate, Dimitrov, just looking back at some of the slams that he's played. I think he's been forced to retire in maybe three or four of the last couple. And then even some of the ATP tours as well. Like, 34 years of age, maybe it starts to catch up on you. Maybe his preparation isn't, or maybe he's not at the same sort of fitness levels as the other, you know, men on tour. But that certainly felt like a massive moment for him.
Mm.
Yeah, like, people will say that Dimitrov is one of the hardest workers on the tour. I've often heard it said that he's one of the guys who really works so hard. I'd say physically he is good, but it just looked like a kind of a freak accident. It's not normal to see someone pulling a pec on a serve. Mm. So I don't know, but look, yeah, good wrenching for him. I hope he can get back soon. But like, someone like him at coming to the end of the career, grass is really the chance to win a slam, because the rallies are shorter. You know, the matches can be a little bit less physically demanding, which will hopefully be the case for Novak. And it just looked like he was playing so well.
Can I ask you about Sinner's next opponent, Ben Shelton? Obviously, would doubts stay in your mind about that injury? I know he's had a day now to obviously get as much physio on whatever was wrong with his arm, elbow, wrist, or his muscle. But will Ben Shelton be looking at that thinking, I can get it in here?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be the injury, because, like, he was still able to serve, he was still able to play. I'd imagine that he's probably going to be okay. I mean, the biggest question for me is Sinner ready to win on grass? Like, he hasn't been really a grass court player. Like, he plays solid, he's good, but does he have the all court game to get to the net to finish points on grass? I'm not convinced yet. And secondly, will he be able to mentally get over what happened in the French Open? Will he be able to get over that so quickly?
Mm. Not another injury, but something that caught my attention as well. Novak Djokovic, for the last couple of rounds, he seems to be, every time he sits down at a break, he seems to be sort of doing hip opener exercises, sort of yoga little postures to try and keep that hip sort of flexible. Would you be concerned that a 38-year-old, or is it that's just sort of intelligence, he's just trying to manage his body?
Yeah, look, with him, there's been so many matches that he looked like he's gone, looked like he's an injury, and then he's bouncing around the place 15 minutes later. I mean, with him, you never know. I think for Novak, it's probably one of his last chances, or if not last chance, to win a slam. He'll give it everything. He really needs to keep the matches short. The last thing he needs is his next round against Carbali, which should be really an easy enough match for him on paper. He needs to keep the matches short. He needs to make sure that he's not in long five-setters. I think physically he can do it. It's just, again, like whether he can match the Sinners of this world, the Alcaraz of this world at this stage. But certainly grass is his best chance.
Okay, and the ladies' quarterfinals continue tomorrow as well. Andreeva is up against Bencic and Swiatek up against Samsonova. Do you expect any fireworks all over that?
Well, I think Andreeva is really interesting. I mean, she could be someone who win multiple slams. She's incredible, 18-year-old. Like one of the real up-and-coming players in tennis, as in Fonseca in the men's, but she's a potential superstar. Bencic, again, like experienced, but I think Andreeva, you know, really not, maybe not this year, but in the next 2-3 years will be somebody that we're going to be talking about. I think winning a slam, if not winning Wimbledon. Swiatek has done well, not a grass court player. I'd like to see her doing well. Her season hasn't been great. Could potentially come through that match, I think. But Andreeva, for me, is the one to watch. Young, nothing to lose, and really has an incredible game. One that actually matches grass.
Four great quarterfinals to look forward to on day 10 tomorrow. Gary Cahill, thanks for joining us on Game On.
No problem.
Game On Rugby.
Welcome back to Game On. It is 6:47 this Tuesday evening. Delighted to say Michael Corcoran has joined myself and Paul Curry in studio. Happy Tuesday to you, Michael.
Happy Tuesday. Is that a thing, is it?
It is now.
Okay. Your world anyway.
Yeah, happy Mondays, happy Tuesdays. And it continues like that for the whole week.
Yeah. Good.
Rugby tomorrow, the Lions up against their latest pre-test test. The ACT
toughest,
Brumbies.
The toughest.
The best team in Australia.
Australian team, yeah, exactly.
And while the Lions are preparing, the Pride is preparing for that, Australia have suffered a major blow. News reached us today that first choice fly half, Noah Loliseo, was ruled out of all of the series because of he's after undergoing surgery on his neck. So that's a big loss for Australia.
It's a huge one because I think he's featured in, I think it's something like 13 of the 15 matches that Joe Schmidt has been in charge of at out half. So he's his banker, for want of a better phrase. The difficulty for the host team, as distinct from the touring team, is the touring team can have 2, 3, 4 players to play in a position, or they can bring somebody from outside in. But the problem is the playing population for the host team, in this case Australia, isn't ginormous.
Yeah. Of the three teams that the Lions regularly play, South Africa, New Zealand and Australia, would it be fair to say that Australia's group of players that they can pick for is the smallest?
Limited enough, I think.
Yes,
yeah, actually.
Okay.
It is tight.
Yeah, okay.
So he's an enormous loss for them. Very talented player. And I mean, if you've, you know, you've done all your, well, you're doing all your preparation. You've done everything in terms of, you're building towards a Rugby World Cup. That's what Joe Schmidt will be thinking, you know. And unfortunately for Noah to lose out is a huge loss for them.
And Joe Schmidt, the man who we both know well, you know better than me even, he will be announcing his Australia squad for the series on Friday.
Yeah, that's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
And I know that he has followed the tour around quite a bit. My understanding is down in Canberra for the game for tomorrow, so obviously he'll be trying to have a look to see what Andy Farrell is trying to do. I mean, he knows the players quite well. That's the reality about it. But as people always say about Joe Schmidt, even when he was here with Australia last November, you expect the unexpected with him, and you could see shoots of what they were trying to do then, back then. Do you know what I mean? I think they'll be a lot better, obviously. So I think it's going to be quite a competitive series.
He'll have a few things up his sleeve.
Always does.
Say.
Expect the unexpected with Joe.
Turning focus back towards the Red Camp and the Lions, Andy Farrell. He's named his strongest side yet to take on the Brumbies tomorrow. 8 Irish players included. A lot of people are saying this is probably the test side.
It won't be too far off it, I would say, regardless of how he kind of talks it up. You know, I mean, the match next weekend was supposed to be against the Rebels, but they're obviously gone out of existence.
Business,
so it's a kind of a makey-uppie team combination of Australian cast-offs and New Zealand cast-offs.
Which isn't going to be
enough
of a test.
Who are not going to get a gig anywhere else, basically. It's like almost like a barbarian-style game. So if you want a serious enough match, I think, and I'm on record as saying this, I think, last week, you know, you've got to pitch up for the game that you got to pitch up at a serious team for the game against the Brumbies, and that's exactly what they've done. Really, I'm not sure it's going to be the starting 15. I mean, there's people getting all sorts of thing in a twist as to whether what are the two Irish centres. Will be there ahead of the two Scottish centres. King Horn is playing full back. Whether Hugo Keenan gets in a look in or otherwise, that's the thing, you know. But I think there's some of the positions are beginning to take a good bit of shape. I think Gibson Park will play out half with Russell. I think Jack Cullen is the best number eight to have, and I think Joe McCarthy is probably highly likely to start alongside Mauro Itoje, who himself, even though he is the captain, isn't guaranteed a place in the starting team.
And Dan Sheehan looks... team just looks better with him.
I think 100% it does, yeah. He's far more dynamic. It'll be good to... Interesting to see how Tadhg Furlong goes. Has an awful lot of mileage in the legs this year. They'll be hoping he stays fit, but Finlay Beelam has been brilliant as well throughout the course of this tour, you know, so...
Will they be aiming Tadhg instead of 50 or 60 minutes?
I would say, I'd say so. And
were you slightly concerned about the victory over New South Wales, 21-10? The other victories looked much easier. You were expecting the Lions maybe to pull away in the second half, and they didn't.
No, it just didn't happen. But that's the nature of a tour like this, you know, because you're trying to integrate so many players over a very, very short space of time. And that's one thing that I've always been a great admirer of Warren Gatland over the years, that he was able to do that on three previous Lions tours, where he just got everybody together basically and started fitting the jigsaw together kind of from the very beginning. I'm not saying Andy Farrell hasn't done that, but it's very, very hard to get a cohesive performance where, you know, you're touring, you're preparing for a match midweek, and then you're trying to think of a match the following Saturday as well. So like they'll be putting everything onto the training pitch and trying to get ready for a Brumbies game, but they'll be thinking about a match next Saturday as well. Do you know what I mean? So like they don't have a whole, because you have to travel and the logistics are getting around the place, they don't have a whole heap of time to prepare together. So I mean, there are aspects of the match that you might be concerned about, but I wouldn't be overly worried. It's all gonna rest on that line, on the test series in a couple of weeks.
More mid-morning entertainment for us tomorrow. It's nice to have a bit rugby in the morning.
Yeah, Michael Corcoran, morning coffee.
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us. We are going to switch our attention. Happy Wednesday tomorrow to you. And we're now going to switch our attention to cycling, because it was a storming day across a very hilly stage of the Tour de France today. And I'm delighted to say Shane Stokes joins us. Shane, how are you?
Good, Andrew. How are you?
Yes, I am very well. And I did enjoy watching the cycling today, I have to say. I was flicking over between the tennis and the cycling. But reigning champion Tadej Pogačar, what a way to take the race lead today. Were you impressed?
Yeah, he didn't actually take the lead in the end. People thought he would with the win, but Matteo Vanderpoel was second and was able to hold yellow.
Okay.
They're level on time.
So they had to run into the car to get in here, so I didn't actually see the scoreboard.
Yeah. It was on stage placings, better stage placings. But I mean, Pogačar is really just—it's just a matter of time. It looks like before he takes yellow. What was really interesting about today was, well, firstly, if anybody watched it or if people still have a chance to watch it, I would absolutely do so, because it was completely spectacular.
It was crazy.
It was crazy. I mean, there was a lot.
Paul
of
Curry's here. Paul, it was just like it was up and down and up and down and left and right. It was like it was like watching racing cars go around a constant stream of chicanes. Is that an accurate description, Shane?
Yeah, it really was. It was so dramatic, and the skill level was incredible to see. What was interesting about the finish was that with about 5 kilometres to go, just over 5 kilometres to go, Tadej Pogačar went all out on a short, steep climb and dropped everyone bar Jonas Vingegaard, who was the rider who beat him twice in the Tour in the past in 2022 and 2023. And this Tour is really shaping up to be a ding-dong battle between the two of them, because normally Pogačar would be ahead of quite far ahead of Vingegaard on a climb like that, and yet it was very tight between them.
It was interesting that when he went and Vingegaard went, no one else, everyone else was just gone. They just said, right, off you go.
Yeah, completely out of the picture. So, there's for Vingo, there's reason for optimism, because last year he had a very bad crash about 3 months before the Tour, was very badly injured and his training was compromised. This year he had concussion in March but came back quicker and is in much better shape. The thing that was interesting about today, apart from the actual result, was that it was Tadej Pogačar's 100th career win. So it's just an astonishing number of wins for any rider. And in terms of the history of it, it is, and I'm just checking now, but I think it was, just from the top of my head, I think he was the fifth youngest rider in history in all of cycling to reach 100 wins. And that's going back a long time ago when you had, it was probably easier to get wins in the past. So yeah, it's very notable and just a further sign of his dominance in the sport.
There was a lot of talk and commentary about Ben Healy possibly going for a stage win today. It was a type of stage that he might like. It had definitely enough chaos in it for him. He held his powder dry and
he got caught behind a crash and was delayed and had to use a lot of energy chasing back on. Did get back on, but he had expended so much energy that he just wasn't there in the finale. And Eddie Dunbar, the other Irish rider, lost time. And the reason why he lost time was because Ben O'Connor, who's the designated team leader of the Jake O'Lula team, cracked again today. Now he's really he did crash early in the tour, but he just hasn't really seemed to be back to his best at all. Ben O'Connor is quite his form is quite temperamental anyway, and things really haven't gone to plan. But Dunbar unfortunately has been charged with pace setting for him in this race. I think what's going to happen is that Ben O'Connor will continue to lose time and Eddie Dunbar may have a chance to go for stages later in the race.
Were you impressed with Matthew van der Poel, how close he stayed to Pogacar and Vingegaard today?
Sure, absolutely. He is good on these kind of climbs. He has done well in the Spring Classics and he is a multiple world cyclocross champion. And cyclocross is all about, A, the precision and skill that you saw with the, you know, that was required to go through all the chicanes, but also short, sharp efforts. But he did pay the price in the finale. He was distanced on that climb with 5 kilometres to go and he just cracked then in the sprint. Still took second, still held on to yellow. But this kind of stage was just about where things tip between what he's good at and what riders like Pogacar and Vingegaard are very good at, which is the longer, harder climbs.
Shane, thanks for joining us on Game On. And we look forward to another great days of action tomorrow. The time trial is on tomorrow. Haven't converted Paul Curry to cycling yet, but he's still watching Germany and Denmark. Germany about to win?
Yeah, they are. You rightly put your faith in a German comeback and they've managed the second half pretty well. There's 4 minutes left, so still maybe an opportunity for a set piece or a moment of magic from one of the Danes, but the Germans looking good to see this out and get another 3 points.
Okay, Paul, that's all we've time for. Thank you for joining me this Tuesday evening. That's all we've time for. I'll be back on Thursday. Maria Crowe will be here tomorrow. Beto da Silva will bring us all the fresh summer tunes on the new music show after the news.